Make a note in your calendar for May 5th. It's just a possibility, but I'll tell you before, it's more than that. You'll remember that Connor Cruz O'Brien, Dr. Connor Cruz O'Brien, was to be here last week, and he was to talk about Ireland and Britain, and he couldn't come. There's a possibility now that he will be here on May 5th. If he is, we will have a special evening on Saturday, May 5th. This is just tentative. I hope it works out. One of the things that I've learned and enjoyed learning most at Vancouver Institute is that this university has attracted some outstanding people to its faculty. Tonight's lecture is one of them. Professor Treisman came to the University of British Columbia from Oxford, where she had taught for 16 years. She stopped last year at Palo Alto, California, where she was visiting fellow at the Center for Advanced Study in Behavioral Sciences. I think that I can do no better by way of introduction than reading to you from a memo that was prepared when Professor Treisman was being considered, when her appointment was being considered last year. Dr. Treisman is a 1961 Oxford PhD, where she has remained as a faculty member and experimental psychologist until the present time. The research from her Oxford laboratory has received the prestigious Spearman Medal for experimental research in psychology and has earned for her an international reputation in the broad fields of attention and memory. One of the references said that her experimental work in attention poses the major challenges for any theory of attention. Another designated her as the world authority on selective attention. This memo concluded that she was one of the most brilliant and productive of the truly world-class experimentalists in psychology today. Professor Treisman has agreed to speak to us on the topic, the psychology of perception and thought.
The very first time I gave a talk, which I had carefully prepared, was to a group of medical students and doctors. And the first question I was asked at the end was, "What's a nice girl like you doing in experimental psychology?" Well, I think both psychology and I have now got beyond that stage. Psychology is established as a science with methods that can give replicable answers to sensible questions. So tonight, I believe I no longer have to defend that claim or myself for wanting to study it. And I can even afford to talk about some of the more puzzling and least understood problems, those where science, in fact, may have to stop short of solutions and perhaps hand over to philosophy and literature. Just to illustrate the rapidity of change in psychology, most of the topics with which I shall be concerned tonight, things like attention, imagery, consciousness, weren't even mentioned in basic textbooks when I was an undergraduate. The focus of my talk tonight will be on consciousness, its role in perception and thought. Psychology is unique among the sciences, I think, in having two fundamentally different kinds of evidence available to it. Objective data about the behavior of the organism and about the physiological processes in his nervous system, and subjective introspection of mental experiences. It used to be thought that the only aim of psychology was to explore and analyze the nature of conscious experience. In the 19th century, the structuralists attempted to analyze by introspection the basic elements of sensation and thought, out of which they hoped to build all the richness of our experience. The method they chose was introspection, But this wasn't just casual glances at what they were feeling or thinking. A very detailed, laborious, and repeated analysis of the sensations produced, for example, by the clicks of a metronome or the smell of a rose. And they emerged triumphantly from this study with a catalogue of 46,708 elementary sensations. Unfortunately, they had no way of either recombining them into meaningful wholes or using them to predict behaviour, or even of defending them against dispute from others whose experience seemed to be different. Then in 1913, the first behaviourists appeared on the scene, and as some cynic put it, mercifully closed the bloodshot inner eye of American psychology. Any talk of mental life became taboo, at least for the behaviourist movement. We're now emerging, in the last 20 years or so, into a new period in which consciousness is again a legitimate object of study. But we now approach it rather differently. We try to link it to other kinds of behaviour, to see, for example, how variations in mental experience correlate with overt performance in various tasks like perception, problem solving, memory, and so on. So we no longer take introspections as the be-all and end-all of the explanations, but we take them as more data to be explained, and we try to see how they relate to the efficiency of the subject in remembering things, solving problems, and so on. I'd like tonight to give you some examples of recent research in perception and thinking. And I've chosen the examples with two aims in mind. Firstly, I'd like to try to highlight one of the most puzzling conclusions which seem to emerge from the study of consciousness. What seems to come out of a variety of findings is that it's actually very hard to find any unique function that consciousness could serve. Virtually any type of activity of which we're normally conscious can, it seems, also be performed without any conscious awareness. The second aim is to illustrate the power of the experimental method when we try to apply it to apparently intractable psychological problems, questions about which we could speculate endlessly using introspection, can in fact be resolved by careful experiments in some cases. What's more, we can now apply experimental methods to study questions that are more closely related to our mental life than rats running mazes or even people rote learning nonsense syllables, which had looked like about the only safe topics for the behaviourists. In the process, however, the very terms that we use to describe our conscious mental operations, things like see, hear, think, choose, may turn out to be inadequate or misleading and have to be refined. The French poet Paul Valéry once said, "The purpose of psychology is to give us a completely different idea of the things we know best." Although he certainly didn't have modern experimental psychology in mind, I think the claim still has some truth in research on mental imagery. This is in some ways a unique area of psychology, and one of the most closely related to subjective experience, of course. Much of our conscious experience consists of imagery. We have visual daydreams, we use images to solve problems, to remember faces and places. The research I'll describe or illustrate would have been unthinkable even two decades ago because it makes direct use of subjective experience. The task we set the subject, in fact, is to produce a private experience in his mind. However, we don't stop there. We ask him not just to have or to describe it, but also to manipulate it in some way which might produce observable effects on his behaviour. So the conclusions we draw are based not directly on introspection, but on the effects of variations in the mental imagery on other tasks and responses that he makes. One question we can ask about imagery is whether images are in any way like photographs or pictures in the head, as they've been called. When we have an image, is it somehow as if we were experiencing again an original perception? Well, let's see. Perhaps you'd like to try answering this question as fast as you can. Which is smaller, a rabbit or a rat? Okay. Now this one. Which is smaller, a rabbit or an ant? Well, most of you probably carried out that task, if you were good enough to cooperate, by forming visual images of those animals. You probably also made the decision faster for the second pair, the rabbit and the ant, which are very different in size. This suggests, perhaps, that the representations you compared, if they weren't pictures, at least kept some analogue of the size differences between the animals. Let's try some more questions. Does a bull have horns? Does a car have wheels? Does a rock have hair? Does a carrot have a stomach? These are all genuine psychological questions. They're in published work. Which of the last two was faster to decide? The one about the rock having hair or the one about the carrot having a stomach? Well, on average, I don't suppose you could have measured it yourselves without stopwatches or timing devices, but on average, subjects are slower in deciding that a carrot does not have a stomach than they are in deciding that a rock does not have hair. Why might this be? Well, maybe because, again, they're answering the question by forming a mental image and, in some sense, inspecting it. Well, that's fine for the rock, you can see straight away whether it has any hair, but the stomach wouldn't be visible from the outside of the carrot, so the answer couldn't be obtained from the image, or at least not without some drastic surgery. Again, some suggestion that in answering questions like that from our long-term knowledge of the world, we actually may use some visual representation in our minds. Well, let's go on. You're probably getting quite good at it by now. Try imagining an elephant. Now sit a mouse next to it. You got them both? Does the mouse have whiskers? Okay, next imagine a fly and sit a mouse next to that, keeping the scale right. Does this mouse have whiskers? Perhaps you found it easier the second time. The whiskers were a bit more visible because the mouse presumably was larger. At least this is what Coslin, who did the experiment, found. His subjects were faster to answer questions about the animal which was larger in their mental image. It seems almost as if people are projecting their image on some kind of mental screen and that it has a limited size, and that they take precautions to keep the larger of the two animals fully in view, which is what they were asked to do. That makes the whiskers very hard to see on a mouse which is sitting beside the elephant's toe. More evidence about just how visual, how much like perception imagery seems to be. The Greeks and the Romans, in fact, used visual imagery to remember things by. They devised mnemonic systems to help them store sequences of items. So, for example, they might form images and locate them in order around a familiar spatial environment. An amphitheater that they were quite familiar with, used to, or a marketplace. So if they had to remember a list of items, they would form a mental image and place the first item, say, on the right of the amphitheater, and then move around it in order. When they needed to recall these items, they would simply scan round their mental picture of the amphitheater, retrieving each item. This is quite a useful method if you have to remember shopping lists or if you're giving a lecture without relying on notes, as I am. The Greeks warned people, they used to teach them to use this system, and they warned users against placing images in dark corners where they might be overlooked. a modern professional mnemonist who was studied by a Russian called Luria, made one of his very rare forgetting errors. He remembered everything for 50 years. One time when he forgot something, it was an egg which he had thoughtlessly placed against a white wall, so effectively camouflaging it, he simply didn't see it. Well, all these observations suggest that images are, in fact, quite similar to pictures in the head. They have sizes, they vary in the amount of detail they contain. We can use them to answer questions or to store things that we want to recall later. But what could this mean? Certainly there are no pictures in the head. For one thing, though, we have no screens to project them on there. Perhaps it means that some of the same neural circuits are active when we form an image and when we perceive an external picture. So in that sense, it might be that we have pictures in the head, simply that the same states of the brain occur, or some very similar states of the brain occur, when we're imagining something as when we're looking at something. The visual system could be involved in a similar, although not an identical way in both cases, otherwise we'd be hallucinating. We can tell images apart from real perceptions. But let's pause a moment. Before we jump to conclusions that these two are very closely related, let's try another experiment. Try visualizing the word language. Do you have it? You have all the letters in front of you? Okay, now read off the letters backwards from right to left. Well, you probably found that much harder than reading them in the other direction, whereas if you'd had the word up on a screen, you would have hardly been slower at all. Here's one big difference between pictures and images. There seems to be more flexibility in what we can do with an external display than with what we can do with what is in our head. Now, let me see if I can master the slide system. If you'd like to look at that slide up on the right-hand side. Right. You probably interpreted that either as a rat or as a man. Some of you may have had time, I left it up a bit long, to see it both ways. Those of you who didn't see it both ways, if you saw it simply as a man, try now to see it in your minds as a rat. And those of you who saw the rat, try to see it as a man. I don't know how successful you're being, but most people find that extremely difficult or simply can't do it. In case you're frustrated, you might like to try again with a slide. It's a man's face, and his chin is the same as the rat's tail. The spectacles are the ears. I don't know which way round you were having difficulty with, but okay. Again, there seems to be a difference. There's a big difference between an external picture and a picture in the head in terms of how easy they are to manipulate. What you seem to have stored when I first showed you the picture was not some kind of mental photograph, just the lines, which you could then restructure at will, but an interpretation of the picture. Some kind of semantic description of what you saw had become part and parcel of the memory, so that mental lines that function as ears simply can't be turned into spectacles, whereas physical lines out there, with a bit of effort, you are able to see as spectacles. Notice that perceiving is also an interpretive activity. It has a very cognitive component to it. It's very hard to see the slide as simply a collection of lines. You all saw it one way or the other, probably. But the difference is that we can reinterpret the lines when they're still physically available. Well, I think these examples of recent work on imagery are probably enough to illustrate how psychologists are trying directly to probe the nature of mental images. What is it that's being done in these experiments? Well, subjects are being asked to manipulate their conscious mental states, just as I asked you. We have no check on how or even whether they're doing this. But we can observe the effects on their efficiency in performing other tasks. How fast you could answer the question about carrots and rocks, for example. We can see whether it helps them remember more accurately, and also what kinds of things it helps them remember, whether it allows them to answer questions. We can also see which other kinds of activities interfere with these uses of imagery, and so we may indirectly be able to draw inferences about the underlying mechanisms. In this way, psychologists have managed to retain some of the rigor of the behaviorists' objective methods without having to treat certain problem areas as taboo. So far, we've been looking at conscious experience without any immediate external stimulus. We've seen that having a mental image is different from looking at a real external scene in some ways. It's not the same as reviving a stored photograph, although it does seem to have quite a lot in common. However, I've also given you some cause to suspect that perception itself is not merely a matter of faithfully reflecting the physical world. The Ratman picture changed its appearance quite dramatically when you changed your interpretation of it. Here's another slide which may illustrate that. I don't know how much sense you can make of those just looking at them, but if I tell you that the one on your left is a midget playing a trombone in a telephone booth, and the one on the right is an early bird catching a very strong worm, the lines become meaningful, and they take on all kinds of new qualities. You can see some depth in them, solidity. The midget is somehow present in that box. In a way in which it really wasn't before. Maybe pure uninterpreted sensations actually never occur in our conscious experience. Maybe worse than that, we may not even be able to rely on conscious experience to be accurate in its report to us of what our senses are receiving. Now, we'll try a bit more technology. I'd like to play you a sentence that I've recorded, if I can get it all to work.
I saw the presiding magistrate sitting in the court.
Perhaps I'll play that once more for you. Was it audible? I can't manipulate it here, I'm afraid.
I saw the presiding magistrate sitting in the court.
Okay, did that sound fairly normal? Anything odd about it at all? There was a bang somewhere in the sentence. I'll also tell you now that one of the speech sounds, one letter, in fact one and a half, were completely deleted from that tape. I know because I cut it out myself, and I know that it's not there. Did you hear which it was? I tried this on my 309 class, and none of them did. I'll play it once more, and if you specifically listen for a missing letter.
I saw the presiding magistrate sitting in the court.
Well, none of my 309 class were able to guess which it was. It's actually the T and part of the S in magistrate, and they're not there. I cut out the sound and replaced it with a noise. That was the bang that you heard. Another interesting point about listening to that sentence is that you probably had very little idea exactly when in the sentence the bang occurred. If one asks people which word did it coincide with or which syllable, they're usually out by maybe two or three syllables, fairly dramatically out. We simply didn't hear what was reaching our ears. You had sufficient evidence from the context of the sentence that the word was magistrate to convince you that it was. You didn't even, I imagine, have a feeling of guessing that the missing letter must have been a T. You actually generated it yourselves and consciously heard, your own construction of it, and in my voice too, probably. What you became aware of, in fact, was the final decision about what had been presented, not the sensations that must have initially reached your brains. Even when you tried, it was impossible consciously to access the sensory data on which you based your decision. A basic rule of perception seems to be that we're merely aware of the outcome of the perceptual process, almost never of the process itself. We can't then ask our subjects voluntarily to manipulate processes which they're not even aware of. So, in studying perception, we need to use methods different from those that we can use with imagery, which is consciously available. So we're now moving on to look at some perceptual experiments, and we're going to be probing inferred events which precede our experience, not the experience itself. This is a different approach. We may find the conclusions much more counterintuitive. They won't any longer have been incorporated into our layman's psychology as men in the street, simply because we haven't had the data to think about. Let me show you now a real coloured photograph of an everyday scene. I'll flash it up fairly briefly so you can watch it. I don't know whether that was visible at all. Was it a bit dark? I can't reverse on this, I don't think. You probably, I hope, all saw a room with a woman in it, a coherent, organised scene with objects arranged in a sensible way. That seems to be the immediate impression that we consciously form, even from a brief flash like that. However, recent research suggests that that coherent, unitary impression has to be somehow reassembled from an array of separate elementary components, colours, lines, curves. Physiological evidence suggests that the early stages in the visual and auditory pathways actually decompose the visual scene into its different properties and lay these out, in fact, in separate maps, almost like different pages in an atlas. One population of nerve cells responds primarily to colour, another to movement, another to orientation, another to depth, and so on. If this is correct, then we must have some way of putting these different properties together again in order to build the objects that we become consciously aware of. Well, this view of perception feels quite implausible. Yet we can set up some psychological experiments which appear to confirm it. In the slide, can you remember what colour was the lamp? Beautiful, thank you. And I didn't plant that either. What was the armchair like? What was the fabric of the armchair? Red, did someone say? Brown? This is lovely. Of course, I'm cheating because I said a few sentences in between. But even I think if I'd asked you immediately, you would have made some of these errors. And the errors take an interesting form. They seem to take the form of switching properties between objects. So when I asked what colour was the lamp, it was actually silver, but it was next to a yellow chair. And this lady very kindly gave me the answer I was hoping for. The chair was actually sort of flowery blue pattern. The rug was striped, but I've had subjects telling me the armchair was striped. The woman's hair, I think, was black and her blouse was red, and I've had a red-haired woman. To make these switches, the colours and shapes must, I think, at some stage have been independently registered. Otherwise, we couldn't have wrongly recombined them. So that's one piece of evidence. We can also try to find out what kind of information is available immediately, fastest, after very little processing time, and what kinds of information is available only later. Some properties seem to give rise to an immediate, easy perceptual grouping. You can probably all, in that slide, without effort, see the boundary. There's a vertical division between the red on the left and the blue on the right. In the next slide, it's probably about equally effortless to see a horizontal boundary between N's and O's. These groupings seem to emerge very, very rapidly if you ask a subject to press a key as soon as he's decided which way the boundary is facing, vertically or horizontally. He's very, very quick. However, in the next slide, you'll find it very much harder. These are exactly the same stimuli, but they're grouped differently. Here, you're forced, if you want to try and find the boundary, to specify how the shapes and colours are put together to form compound objects. That this circle is red and that this N is blue. Exactly the same grouping task becomes slow and effortful when we have to specify how to put together those different properties, colour and shape. Similarly, if we ask subjects to search a large display for a particular object in it, they can find it extremely quickly if it has a single property which differentiates it from all the others. You can very easily, I suppose, find somebody with red hair if she's the only red-haired person in the audience. Not so easily if you're having to specify that she not only has red hair but blue eyes. If you're looking for the only green item in the display, it seems to jump out at you extremely rapidly. If you have to look for a green tea and it's in a background of red T's and green X's, you're very slow. In fact, in that case, we are apparently forced to scan each item in turn. We have to somehow look at them one by one if we want to specify how their properties are combined. When we're prevented from doing that, from attending to more than one or two objects, as you were when I flashed the picture of the room up, we get an illusion of seeing the whole thing, but in fact we see only one or two objects veridically or reliably, and we guess the rest from their colours or shapes separately. Perception seems then to require at least two stages, the first in which we register the separate simple properties, and a second in which we integrate them to form more complex multidimensional objects. And both these stages precede any conscious awareness of the scene, so we can't explore them directly by introspection. We have to use other measures like errors or the amount of time taken to perform different tasks. At what stage then do the results of perceptual analysis become accessible to us? Is the difference between conscious and unconscious levels one of complexity, so that we become aware only of fully elaborated scenes after they've been nicely dolled up for us? As we'll see, this assumption is too simple, although it may contain some element of truth. One of the most striking features of conscious awareness is its relatively narrow focus. To a first approximation, we seem to follow only one series of events at a time. We can switch between them, but only one of them dominates. We seem only to entertain a single idea, although it can be quite a complicated one. This limited span of attention or awareness has fascinated people for at least a century. Sir William Hamilton in 1859 did one of the first experiments on it. He threw a handful of beans onto a tray and tried to determine how many he could take in with a single glance, how many he could count. He found that up to about 7 beans, he could become immediately aware of the number. After that, he was forced to estimate or count the beans one by one. The study of attention, like the study of imagery, fell into some disrepute with the behaviorist movement. But about 25 years ago, it was revived in a rather different context, that of listening to speech. Cherry, who reopened this field of research, christened it the cocktail party problem, because a cocktail party is one of the situations in which it's most strikingly manifest. We usually have no difficulty focusing on one speaker and following what he says, while shutting out the general hubbub around us. What reaches our ears, though, is a very complex sound wave. It doesn't arrive all sorted out nicely into Mr. X and Miss J. We have dozens of voices mixed and blended together, and somehow we sort out the component frequencies which belong to one conversation and discard the rest. Or do we discard them? It's of some interest to specify just what it is that we know about the unattended sounds. In the history of this field, there have been several distinct phases. People switched from saying we discard everything to saying we know everything and we simply don't become aware of it. To make the problem a bit more amenable to controlled research, we can bring the relevant aspects into the laboratory. And the way people did this was to play two or more simultaneous speech messages to subjects over loudspeakers or over headphones and ask them to attend selectively to one of the two. They find this quite easy to do, and you can check that they're doing it accurately by getting them to repeat it back as it's going along. We can then ask them what they know about the message that they were not attending to. Typically, they can tell us something about whether it was a man or woman speaking and where she was speaking from, roughly in the room, and roughly how fast and how loudly. He would notice if we switched to music or if we played some extraneous sound or click. However, the subject can't tell us anything about the words or the meaning if we simply ask him to report. He doesn't even notice if we switch to a different language. We can play something in German, and he won't notice that there's been any change. We can play repeated lists of English words over and over again and ask him what he remembers, and the answer is nothing. As with the visual experiments I described earlier, we seem first to pick up simple features for all the stimuli reaching our senses, like whose voice it is and how loudly she's speaking. We then narrow down and look at or listen to only one thing at a time. So that seemed a nice, straightforward story 20 years ago, and these findings led to a theory put forward by Broadbent, which is widely recognized as the beginning of modern cognitive psychology. An essential aspect of that theory was that the unattended message is not fully perceived. The words and meanings that comprise the message fail to reach our conscious awareness. An unattended message is simply detected as a string of speech sounds, stored for a very brief moment in a kind of echo box, and then lost forever without making any contact with the mind. That was the theory. Well, it was a little more elaborate than that. It had boxes and arrows, but I won't bother you with those. However, a series of studies which were stimulated by this theory quickly showed it to be inadequate. The idea that unattended messages are blocked from any perceptual analysis, if we take it seriously, means that it should be as if that information had never been presented. Well, is it? Murray tried inserting the subject's own name into the unattended message. About half his subjects stopped repeating back the other message, the one they were supposed to be listening to, and said, "Oh, that's my name." Murray suggested that our own names may be so important to us that we've somehow set up a special device to detect them at a very early stage of processing. So before we shut out unwanted messages, we first check to see whether they contain our own names and maybe one or two other highly important signals. Well, that could work, provided it is very few special words. But it couldn't really account for the next result that I obtained. Instead of the subject's own name, I put a highly probable, highly relevant word in the unattended message. So if the attended ear that the subject was listening to was getting, for example, the sentence, "The boy sat at a mahogany," the next word on the unattended ear would be "table," highly probable in that context, while the next word in the attended message would be something quite unlikely. Well, when I set up this experiment, I found that subjects occasionally picked up that highly probable word from the unattended ear or loudspeaker without even realizing that it came from the wrong ear. This finding can't be explained in the same way as the own name effect, by postulating we have some kind of special name detector. This is because any word in the language can potentially be made relevant and probable by the context it came in. So we can't set our thresholds very low so that we jump every time we hear the word table, because it could just as well have been a completely different word that I made likely. It suggests that rather more gets through from the unattended words than we had believed before, although it seems to be only under rather special circumstances. I suggested that attention may, instead of blocking irrelevant inputs, reduce them very considerably, severely cut down the amount of sensory evidence that gets through, but that we also are, at any one time, perhaps especially sensitive to words that we expect or need to hear. The tape with Magistrate that I played you earlier shows that we are capable of hearing sounds that aren't there, provided that they're very predictable in context. Perhaps what happened with the word table in this attention experiment is related to what happened to us in that case. The word had been reduced in my experiment by, by physically removing the sound from the tape. It was actually missing. But maybe selective attention also reduces the words coming in on the unattended channel, but the highly predictable words we supply missing data for, the others we don't. However, there is an alternative possibility. Perhaps we do hear and fully understand both messages, except that we promptly forget the unattended one, so that by the time the experimenter asks us what did it say, we've forgotten, unless it's very important or relevant. One way around this problem is to try and get an immediate response. We can introduce a command into the unattended message, which the subject is to obey immediately if he can, in fact, detect it. So this time I inserted the word tap at a few unpredictable points in both the attended and the unattended message, and asked subjects to tap the table immediately whenever they heard the word in either ear, while keeping their attention fixed on the one that they were supposed to be listening to. And I found there was a very big difference in the number of these tap commands that they picked up in the attended and in the unattended ear. They got about 87% in the attended ear and only 8% in the unattended ear. So it looks as if we couldn't explain away the limits to attention by saying they're really limits to memory. Occasional important or relevant words do seem to get through, enough for us to prick up our ears at a cocktail party if anything relevant is said. But most of the unattended words don't seem to make it through to trigger either awareness or responses. However, the plot was about to thicken again. The best way to illustrate it is with an experiment that was done here at UBC by Raymond Courtine. He chose another way of making words relevant or important to subjects. He paired one class of words with a mild electric shock. So he played subjects lists of words, and every time they heard a city name, like Paris, London, and so on, he gave them a small shock. The shock wasn't harmful, of course, but it was unpleasant enough to produce an emotional response, which can be picked up as a change in the skin conductance. And after a while, this change comes to be evoked by the emotional words, even when the shock is no longer being paired with them. So now Courtine had a class of words which were both relevant to the subject and produced a measurable physiological response without his having to question the subjects afterwards or get them to make any voluntary movement, like pressing a key. He then ran a selective listening experiment, like the others, in which occasional city names were inserted into the unattended message. What he found was very interesting. On about a third of the trials, subjects did show this physiological indication of emotion to the city names in the unattended message, looked as if they were being registered. However, his subjects never heard the city names. When he asked them afterwards, "Did you hear anything?" they said no. And in fact, in an otherwise identical experiment, Courtine also asked them to press a key any time they heard a city name. And they were unable to do this, even on trials when the emotional response showed that they had registered a city name. Well, what emerges is rather an odd picture, which is rather hard to reconcile with our everyday concepts of what hearing and understanding mean. We seem to have two or even three kinds of hearing here. Subjects heard the sound of the unattended words consciously, in the sense they knew a woman was speaking, we'll say. They heard the meaning of the unattended city names only in the sense that this meaning triggered this physiological response. They did not hear it in the sense that they could become consciously aware of it or press a key to indicate that they'd heard it. Our ordinary common sense use of the words see and hear seems inadequate in this experimental context. The meaning of the words seems to be present somehow in our minds, in some corner, without being distributed to everybody, all the people. One's reminded of some kind of large organization in which information which has been received by the organization is made selectively available to just a few functionaries and not to others. There are other examples of this dissociation which are appearing. We can, for example, flash a word very briefly on a screen and ask the subject what he sees. And if it's short enough, he will only see the flash and be unable even to tell us whether a word was presented in it. However, he may still be able to tell us whether it was a nice or nasty word, or whether its meaning was more like the meaning of, for example, friend than cloud. Very recent findings suggest that we can even get aesthetic responses to invisible patterns. If you flash them too fast for conscious experience, subjects will still sometimes be able to tell you whether that flash was an attractive one or an unattractive one, depending on which pattern it contained. Another very interesting dissociation between behavior and awareness can occur with damage to some areas of the brain. This is particularly interesting, I think, because it adds a third source of data to correlate to behavior and to mental life. Again, we simply look for covariation or dissociation rather than causal relations, but this time we're looking for to the psychological experiments I've just described on normal people is a patient who's been studied by Larry Weisskranz at Oxford. This is a man who's had an operation for a tumour which removed half his occipital lobe. That's the primary visual receiving area in his brain. He recovered well from the operation, but has a blind area which covers half his visual field, so he simply doesn't see anything in one half of the field. Now, it had previously been known that monkeys with similar damage to the visual area did appear to regain some vision. They could accurately point at lights and even discriminate fairly salient properties like colours or movements. It seemed that they were probably using a different visual area. So Weisskranz wondered whether any similar information might still be available to human patients. This would, of course, be very important, despite the fact that they were not able to experience it consciously. So he decided the best way was to try similar tests to those used with monkeys. Maybe it was simply unfair to ask human beings to report verbally. So he told this patient to point at a light, even if it felt like pure guessing, which it did. The man was rather indignant and said, "But you know, I can't see anything." But after some initial protests, to his surprise, when he tried to guess, he in fact pointed at the light, and he did this over and over again. Weisskranz then tried a discrimination task. He showed him a cross on some trials, a circle on other trials, and asked him which it was. Again, the man protested, and again he got a very large proportion right, even while denying that he could see anything at all. Here we have another dissociation between behavior and experience. The missing brain area seems to be necessary for seeing in the sense of conscious awareness, but not for seeing in the sense of detecting where or what something is. Let's pause to recap what we've found so far. We've seen that consciousness doesn't seem to be essential to perception, that we can identify the meanings of words which we aren't aware we heard or saw, and that the patient with blind sight, as it was called, when pressed to guess, could even locate and name objects in an area which appeared to have no vision at all. We've also seen the converse, that we can be consciously aware and convinced of the existence of sounds and sights which never actually occurred, the tea in magistrate, for example. Consciousness seems to be only loosely coupled to what goes on in our perceptual systems. It seems to be telling us a story about the world, which is based on the information reaching the senses, but which also incorporates other knowledge and even speculations. There are many things it never tells us about at all. We're fortunately spared the details of our digestive system, except when it runs into trouble, and we rely with blind faith on our muscles to hold us upright, our hearts to keep pumping, and our kidneys to do whatever they're paid to do. Some skilled activities may even go to pieces if we start thinking about each movement. For example, if you try to control each note separately when you play the piano, you soon run into trouble. It's like the rhyme about the centipede, who was happy quite until a frog in fun said, "Pray which leg comes after which?" This raised her mind to such a pitch she lay distracted in the ditch, considering how to run. Seems that some highly learned skills are better delegated to lower level controls than constantly supervised by consciousness, at least once they've been well learned. So is consciousness reserved for higher things? Do we keep for it the complex decisions, the problems to be solved, the moral and emotional choices? It certainly more often seems to tell us about these than about our kidneys. They are the more usual preoccupations we experience. But if we think about it, the coupling is quite loose here too. When you solve arithmetic problems like 5 plus 2 or 5 plus 4, you're usually aware only of hearing the words and the answer coming straight into your mind. You probably wouldn't guess that 5 plus 4 takes longer than 5 plus 2 and that the difference is about the same as the difference between 5 plus 6 and 5 plus 4. We take exactly 20 milliseconds longer for each extra unit to be added, as if we solve those problems by successively adding 1 and 1 and 1 and 1 to 5 as many times as necessary. Well, if we do this, that's just a hypothesis which fits the data, we certainly do it so fast, at about a rate of 50 a second, that we're quite unaware of what's happening. The fastest we can count to ourselves in our heads is about 10 a second, which is 5 times slower than this unconscious adding. From this rather humble form of problem solving to the breakthrough discoveries of great scientists, perhaps we'll find a change in the role of consciousness. Well, it's not clear that we do. You can read reports of scientists making their great discoveries. Poincaré, for example, once took a break from his mathematical work to go on a geological excursion. And he writes, "Having reached Coutances, we entered an omnibus to go to some place or other. At the moment I put my foot on the step, the idea came to me without anything in my former thoughts seeming to have paved the way for it. The transformations I had used to define the Fuchsian functions were identical with those of non-Euclidean geometry." So it isn't only 2 plus 2 and other such overlearnt computations that seem to pop fully fledged into our conscious awareness. A well-known physicist once said, "We often talk about the three B's, bus, bath, and bed. This is where the great discoveries are made in our science." Well, what seems to reach conscious awareness after a session in one of the three B's is the solution, the result of the thought, not the process itself. However, we ought to be careful, I think, before drawing the inference that we too could win Nobel Prizes by spending more time in the bath. In every case, the problems to which solutions emerge so unexpectedly had also been worked on for days, weeks, or months, with very concentrated awareness, and sometimes it's the environment that suffers rather than the thinking, so much so that Sir Isaac Newton once boiled his watch instead of an egg. It seems likely that a great deal of conscious work organizing and structuring the information is necessary before the solution emerges unconsciously. It is a fascinating question, though, whether there's any difference in the kind of thinking that's accompanied by awareness and the kind that is not. Whether, for example, the kind of thinking of which we're conscious is of necessity sequential, one thing at a time, and therefore more orderly and organized, simply because our conscious span of attention is too limited to contain many ideas simultaneously. The accounts I've given you suggest that at least associations and perhaps inferences continue to be formed without our knowledge. Well, if consciousness isn't essential either for perception or for at least some of thinking, maybe it reflects our control of action. It's the decision-making center which weighs the arguments for and against the different courses of behavior that we might follow. That sounds very plausible. It makes sense to have a unitary central control to organize our activities to stop us running off in two directions at once. Computers are usually organized in this way with an executive program which orders what happens when. However, Freud many years ago sowed some major doubts about the accessibility of many of our motives. It was, of course, he who originally planted the idea of a great surging mass of emotional and cognitive activity which is kept well underground and emerges only in dreams, slips, and symptoms. Recently, experimental psychologists have looked at some much more mundane choices, like which pair of stockings should I buy, and asked how conscious our reasons for these decisions might be. Well, that if we introspect when we're buying stockings, there's no question we know why we choose them. However, in one experiment by Nisbet and Wilson, women were shown four identical pairs of stockings. They weren't told they were identical. They were asked to choose one pair, and they also had to say why they'd chosen it. It turned out that four times as many women picked the pair on the right, on the extreme right, compared to the pair on the extreme left. That's a large difference. But not one subject ever spontaneously mentioned that she chose the ones on the right because that's where they were. When asked specifically whether the position might have affected their choice, virtually all the subjects denied it, usually with a worried glance at the interviewer, suggesting that they felt either they'd misunderstood the question or they were dealing with a madman. That's a quotation from Nisbet and Wilson. Well, they collected many other examples of situations where people made choices but were quite unaware of one or more factors, even though these had clearly had a major impact on the group as a whole. They concluded that these findings throw some doubt on the idea that we have any privileged access to the causes of our behavior, even in these relatively harmless-looking choices. We may be no better placed to report these than, say, a twin brother would be if he knew our past equally well and were asked to guess our present choice. When the causes are plausible ones, as they usually are for buying stockings, or salient and obvious, both we and our twin brothers are likely to be correct. But when they make little sense, like choosing stockings because they happen to be on the right-hand end, introspection by the subject himself may be no more accurate than the common sense of the observer. But if the reports of subjects don't differ from reports of observers, then it may be unnecessary to assume that the former are drawing on any kind of fount of privileged knowledge. So what is going on? Subjective experience seems to be telling us a story, a unified, coherent, sensible story about the world around us and about our own behavior, what we're doing in it. It's often correct, but not always. It's certainly highly selective. It seems, as Julian James has put it, to narratize, to make sense of things, and to excerpt, to pick out tidbits. It's ever ready to explain anything we happen to find ourselves doing with great conviction. It can, it seems, even be split in various ways. We may even get two accounts rather than one. Probably the most dramatic instance of this can be closely tied to a change in the brain again. This is with some patients you may have heard of, with whom a surgeon called Sperry has been working. These were people who suffered from major epileptic seizures that were severely incapacitating them. And their epilepsy was controlled by an operation which surgically separated the right half from the left half of the brain. The patients recovered well and showed very little handicap resulting from the surgery and were cured of their epilepsy. They seemed outwardly very normal. However, when they were carefully tested in specially controlled situations, some fascinating observations were made. It's possible to show stimuli, visual stimuli, exclusively to one half of the brain, simply by showing them to the left or right of where the subject is looking. We can then find out what the patient is seeing by asking him to tell us, either verbally or by pointing or making some other movement. It turns out, or we knew beforehand, that the right hemisphere, the right half of the brain, is unable to control speech. It can't tell us anything verbally. That seems to be exclusively controlled by the left half of the brain. But the right half can clearly demonstrate that it is seeing a stimulus by, for example, getting the left hand to point to its name. If you show, say, a key and the word key together with a lot of other words, the left hand can point at the correct word to name the object, or it can write it or draw it. If such a patient is shown a dollar sign, say, to the right half of the brain and a question mark to the left half of the brain, he will draw a dollar sign with his left hand and say he saw a question mark. If he's asked why he drew a dollar sign, the left half brain, that's the speaking half, remember, says, "Oh, I must have done it unconsciously." It has no direct access to what's going on in the right half brain. However, the right half brain isn't incapable of thought. For example, it can tell us what things go together conceptually. It will tell you that a 50-cent coin goes sensibly with a dollar sign, that a nail goes with a hammer, and so on. It will even make the patient blush or laugh when he's shown a picture of a nude, again without the left half brain knowing what's happening or why the patient is blushing. As Sperry said, it's as if there are two minds in one body. The normal unity of conscious experience clearly depends on the integrity of the brain, the links between its two hemispheres, although nobody really understands how. Well, I'm coming to the end. I've tried to illustrate the kinds of information that psychology can supply about our mental life while still remaining a science. I think we have learnt from these experimental studies some fascinating facts about when and where conscious experience appears, what kinds of thinking, perceiving, and acting it normally selects and reflects for us. It's useful, too, to be reminded how much of our mental life goes on without awareness, and that the submerged mass of the iceberg is not submerged exclusively, or even perhaps primarily, by Freudian censorship. Our conscious experience is where we live. This unique reflection or expression of mental events is therefore closely bound up with what we call the self, and with our everyday use of words like see, feel, think, decide. So that's what determines their meaning in the language. But it's often a poor guide to understanding the underlying processes. Is the layman, and I'm a layman too, ever be satisfied with the kinds of conclusions we can draw as psychologists? I think we should distinguish two kinds of curiosity here. We are certainly answering more questions about mental life than we would have thought possible, or maybe even desirable, 2 decades ago. But it is equally true that there are other questions which psychological investigation is inherently incapable of answering. Questions like, what is consciousness? How does it emerge? How does it interact with our physical bodies? What sort of causality links the two? One important reason may be that we don't even know yet how to put those questions. It's not clear that they make sense. They aren't in a sufficiently clear and explicit form for us to know what an answer would look like if we got it. To explain something is normally to give a simpler model or description of it. With physical systems, we can look for models or analogies in other physical systems. With conscious experience, our descriptions and analogies are going to be to other conscious experiences and may therefore, I think, be better captured by literature than by science.
Professor Treisman has agreed to answer questions. The question period will be short because tonight we're having coffee in the lobby and she has agreed to stay and take further questions there. I would ask now that when we do go out there, you please ask a question and move on and let somebody else, though undoubtedly their question won't be as important as yours. And we'll one question each, no repeats tonight. Here.
If you show somebody a flashing light, if it enters that computer, electrical activity in the visual cortex, if you ask somebody to imagine a flashing light, can it detect any electrical activity?
The question was, if you flash a light, a real light in the external world, and if you're picking up electrical activity from the brain through the scalp, you can pick up an electrical response of the brain to that flashing light. The question was, can you do the same when a person imagines light rather than actually seeing it? This is a fascinating question. I don't think it's been done. In fact, I went to a conference last month in which that was suggested as an interesting experiment to try. I hope I'm not misleading you, but this would certainly make a nice link with the physiology and try and bring our three kinds of data closer together. Yes?
Could you comment on subliminal advertising on television?
Yes, I carefully steered clear of that. There was a time, I think about 20 years ago, when this was all the rage, when people first claimed that it was possible to get unconscious perception of briefly flashed material, and that this would somehow access in a surreptitious way all the hidden emotions and underground wishes and motivations that advertisers particularly would like to get at. This raised a fair amount of furore, and I think it was banned. I don't believe it's done now. Recent experiments which have revived this possibility suggests that, as I said, it is possible to get some detection of meaning and of pleasure or aesthetic appreciation even when we don't consciously perceive the things. However, it's quite difficult to get it. I had a student who was studying it and he would get it in one experiment and then it would disappear in the next. It's not clear that we do... Well, I think there's been no research to show whether there's a different kind of effect of subliminally seen words or pictures than the effect they have consciously. This would be a very interesting thing to find out. Yes?
I wish to know whether you agree with me that in human psychology, a lot is based on learned behavior.
Certainly, yes. The question was, in human psychology, is a great deal based on learned behavior? Certainly an enormous amount. We build up an enormous storehouse of knowledge through our lives. We learn language, of course. There's some interest recently in the question just how much is built in, how much is innate. And there were some fairly extreme claims made 10-15 years ago that language was built in the sense that the child was born with some fairly specific systems in his brain which would guide him to acquiring human natural language. The reason this was postulated was that it's such a complicated thing. Linguists even now haven't succeeded in describing all the rules of language, and yet a two-year-old within 6 months or a year is speaking it fairly fluently. So there was some suggestion that some predispositions or some kinds of strategies for learning might be built in, but certainly the bulk of our knowledge, of course, has to be acquired, and this has an enormous influence on the way we see the world and understand it and solve problems. Yes, the one in the corner. Yes. Very unreliable. The question was, when I showed you the picture in a brief flash of the woman sitting in the room, and you were making very kindly the errors that I wanted you to make, does this suggest that we're normally as unreliable, for example, witnesses of car crashes or other kinds of events which have to be described in law courts? And the answer is certainly there's a great deal of scope for misperception, misremembering. There's been some fascinating research done recently on that, in fact, which I didn't have time to bring in. You can influence the way people remember a film, say, of a car crash by the way you phrase questions about it. In one experiment, this is work by Beth Loftus, she showed the same film to three different groups of subjects. A car crashed into a lamppost, I think. And she asked them, how fast was the car going when it crashed into the lamppost, was one group. How fast was the car going when it collided with the lamppost, was another group. How fast was the car going when it made contact with the lamppost, was the third group. And lo and behold, the first group, the crashed group, said it was going at 50 miles an hour. The collided group said, no, 40 miles an hour. And the made contact with group said 30 miles an hour. So really, we're very amenable. And of course, they weren't conscious that they were influenced in any way by the sentence. A week later, she called them back and asked them, was there any broken glass in the film? The ones who'd had the question, how fast were the cars going when they crashed into the lamppost, said they saw glass in the film. There wasn't any. Yes. Well, there's a nice research project. The question was, the women who chose the stockings on the right, were they all people who read from left to right? If we got some Israelis who read from right to left, would they have chosen the stockings on the left? Well, if I could get a grant to go to Israel, I could tell you the answer. Yes? Yes, I think this is the suggestion that Piaget made and many others, that the question was, sorry, I keep forgetting to transmit it, the question was, is it our ability to retain visual memories in our minds that makes it possible for the child to learn language in the first place? Certainly, in order to acquire language, the child has to have the ability to represent the world to himself, to form to recognize that an object is the same when he sees it in different places. So he has to retain some kind of concept of that object, even in its absence, which will bridge the gap from one occurrence to another. And it's onto this kind of conceptual representation, probably, that he learns to map the language. He learns the words which refer to them and can comment on them. Yes?
Yeah.
Yes, the question was, aren't we then doing students a great disservice when we put them in a language laboratory and restrict them to auditory input over headphones rather than giving them also some visual scenes to which these sentences could refer? That's an interesting question. Of course, by the time we get students learning foreign languages, they've already got a fairly rich visual life of imagery and so on, so one hopes they are supplying some of it for themselves. But it would be interesting to find out whether there is any advantage in also giving them visual pictures or films on which the French or whatever it is they're learning comments. It might well be helpful. Of course, there are some books which teach you language entirely through pictures without translation. I'm not sure, I don't know how well those work, but they're quite interesting. Yes?
I'd like to pursue your Scotland example further. It might ensure you're getting this research map. Are the left-handed women more likely to choose Scotland than left-handed women to choose those on the left?
The question was, are right-handed women more likely to choose those on the right than left-handed women? We've done an awful lot of research on right-left differences, on handedness. There's been a fair amount of research on choosing stockings. I don't think anyone's put them together yet. But my guess would be yes, probably they would, yes. Right-handed people tend to be right-dominant in general, and so this might be the explanation or part of the explanation. It would be interesting to look at left-handed people. Although left-handed people tend also to be left-brained. That is, the organization of the brain, apart from handedness, very often matches that of right-handed people rather than being a mirror image. There are a few left-handers who are completely mirror-imaged, but the majority, I think, are not. Yes? Yes, the question was that the patient with so-called blind sight, the half a blind visual field, who was nevertheless in the laboratory able to show some signs of seeing in it, was he also able to use visual information outside the laboratory, for example, to avoid obstacles coming up on the left? That's a very interesting and crucial question. I wish I knew the answer. Another very interesting question in relation to him, I think, is what happens as he goes on being given feedback, being told when he's right and when he's wrong. Will he eventually become conscious of these sights that he has in his head somewhere but cannot access at the moment? That's fascinating. The last time I asked Larry Weisskrantz what's happening, he told me, well, he's now getting a kind of gut feeling about whether it's a cross or circle. Gut is a bit far from vision, but maybe it'll come. I don't know. It would be nice to know.
One more question.
Yes? Yes. The question is, there's been some work done by Penfield in Canada, actually. He's a surgeon, and when he operates for epilepsy, he has to expose the brain in the conscious patient, and he stimulates different areas of the brain in order to make sure that he's not going to remove a critical area, like the area controlling language, for example. But incidentally to this very practical reason for doing it, he's also made some fascinating observations of what happens when you stimulate the brain electrically in conscious patients. And the question referred to a finding that in some areas of the brain, if you stimulate with a very small electric current, the patient seems to re-experience very vividly memories of past scenes, past places that he or she has been in before. Here we're evoking a conscious experience simply by putting an electrode in the brain and activating certain neural circuits. So here we have another very close link between brain behavior and conscious awareness. It's not been fully checked how genuine these memories are. It could be simply that the patient has a feeling that he's been there before. It's also not been checked whether they're a really random selection. Penfield drew the inference that we must have a complete videotape recording of everything that's ever happened to us in our lives, somehow laid down in our brains, and we simply have trouble accessing it. If you can access it artificially by stimulating the brain, we can sample random scenes from it. I think this conclusion may be going beyond the evidence, although it's a fascinating speculation.
Thank you. I will ask Professor Sudfeldt to express our thanks.
I once heard a distinguished colleague compare experimental psychologists to Christopher Columbus. The similarity is as follows. First of all, experimental psychologists, when they start out on their voyage, don't know where they're going. Secondly, when they get there, they don't know where they are. And thirdly, they do it all on somebody else's money. To pursue the analogy a little bit further, I guess tonight we were the passengers. We had to splash through a lot of water to get on this trip, but I think we all found it fascinating and enlightening. And on behalf of all of us, I would like to thank the navigator.
We're going to have coffee now out in the lobby, and Professor Treisman has agreed to take one question at a time, but let her have coffee first, will you? Night.